Hey, y'all. It's Jade Harrell, Director of On-Demand Content and Community Partnerships for St. Louis Public Radio and the Executive Director of We Live Here. I am so proud to share this episode of We Live Here with you as we contribute to the national conversation around the state of education. We've had this conversation before, many times, and with our children returning to their classrooms, we have to ask ourselves, what's changed? In many ways, we're hearing and seeing the same things. It's a conversation that leads the headlines and forecasts a grim outlook for America's students. The state of public education in the United States today surveys similarly nationwide as challenges continue to surface. PublicSchoolReview.com, an online resource providing free, detailed profiles of U.S. public schools and their surrounding communities, list funding deficits, school closures, decline in school safety, access to technology, and student mental health challenges among the top areas of difficulty facing public schools. We're jumping into the deep and vast waters of this discourse with a concentration on ideas that flank the mainstream reports. We've discovered beaming rays of hope from right here at home. Education advocates, activists, administrators, and innovators who dedicate their lives toward improving the outcomes of students and their communities.
So your back is not to the video. And if you can raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, and state your name.
I, Alicia Sanye.
Do hereby swear upon my oath.
Do hereby swear upon my oath.
That I do not hold any other elected office.
That I do not hold any other elected office.
In the city of St. Louis.
In the city of St. Louis.
That's Alicia Sanye.
I have a bachelor's degree in psychology myself. I've been a student activist for a long time, and I am the newest Board of Education member in the city of St. Louis.
To serve as a member of the Board of Education.
Of the Board of Education.
Of the city of St. Louis.
Of the city of St. Louis.
Catching the attention of the region, Alicia's roots in activism and organizing earned her the St. Louis Public School Board appointment by one of her most influential supporters, City of St. Louis Mayor Tashara Jones.
I feel like it helps make this like super historic to be appointed by the first Black female mayor of your city. Like, is excellent, and she's come out the gate and done some amazing things, and I'm just excited at what that means for us as a board and as a district to be in these relationships and to work in community.
I got to see some of the privileges I had as a student that some of my, you know, fellow freedom fighters did not have, and just really felt a responsibility to make sure that I was leveraging my student position for all of the privileges that it meant, holding my institution accountable and understanding like what that meant for me moving forward as far as like, you know, jobs that I might have access to, certain class privileges, and also the importance of being willing to risk all of that for justice and for a society that makes all of it better. I think the idea of running for any sort of office at 25, it doesn't matter what you do, people will find something. And you know, you'll hear, oh, well, no one on this ballot knows your name in this way. But in my case, because of Board of Education, it's like, well, you don't have any kids in the district. And it's like, well, I don't have any kids, period. I'm 25, I don't have any children yet at all. Or you're young, you're inexperienced, you're not an educational expert. And it's like, well, how do you define an educational expert? Because if I went to school K through 12, and then I managed to get a degree while also leading a movement, and then going on to get a job, and I'm about to be returning to school, to nursing school, which is like not the easiest thing to get into. Like, how are we defining expertise? And also, like, what do we think that there's a certain age? Do you have to have children? Do you have to take on these certain social titles before you're in position to lead your community?
And her plate is full. She continues to confront academic inadequacies at the same time she pursues personal career growth and community development goals. She works hard, but she knows it's unsustainable to do this work alone.
I don't want to be the only one in these spaces. I don't want to be the only one in these seats. I don't want to be like the token. I want this to be something that all of us can have.
She champions for community to ensure that the voices as well as the full potential of students is realized.
I think it's super important because I think what we know about oppression and what we know about our society is things start at micro levels and then span out to macro levels. So like, you know, if you're at a reading level that's below third grade, they say that there's a bed waiting for you in prison, and that's factually proven. Every child that you can increase literacy for, every child that you can improve, you know, reading benchmarks and follow and monitor that, is a child that you're helping to give access to better opportunities, and also you're helping to stray from a certain path.
Dr. Howard Fields agrees.
We have to provide student voice on a lot of matters, and oftentimes we're so busy talking about the outcomes, we're so busy talking about what they don't have, but we don't get a chance to listen to the narrative, their experiences on the way to school. What are some of those things that they see that can really enhance, not just for themselves, but for their classmates?
Dr. Fields is an assistant superintendent of human resources, co-founder of BMESTL, which is Black Males in Education, and the co-founder of Edu Openings, a source for educators to find jobs, professional development, and freelance work. He affirms that clear pathways toward our students' greatest potential are obscured, and that a key missing element from the mission and priority of administrators is equity.
Educational equity should be defined as creating and or eliminating policies, systems, and practices in schools that impact the experiences, outcomes, and access to resources for students from previously excluded groups.
Which is why he doesn't use the term underrepresented.
From my experiences, underrepresented does not encapsulate what has happened in our field, particularly when we're talking about our students. Well, what I find in education, there have been some students, there have been some communities, there have been some voices that have been previously excluded due to our structures. A lot of people will say, well, you know, let's take gifted education, for example. Well, you know, we can't find a lot of Black scholars or Black students who would be geniuses, and so they are underrepresented. What I've just done is I have removed all accountability, or the majority of accountability, from me and putting it back on those that could not be found. And I'm just saying, so thus they are underrepresented. Well, if in fact our structure is set up where only teachers are really getting a chance to provide a perspective in terms of what this student can or cannot do, then that's not going to benefit Black and Brown students. If we create a structure where you have to be at the school, or you have to have access to the ways that we communicate as a school system that's most beneficial for us, then that's not going to benefit some of those students or families who don't communicate with great regularity in those same medians. Some of our students do so well that they should be in gifted courses, but they're not. So how does access to the resources so that they can flourish even more, what does that sound and look like? And so thus, some of the things we do in schools continue to exclude some of our most delicate groups that we are appearing to want to have conversations about supporting more.
These pioneers are the vanguard. They do things differently. They see things from different angles, and they're tapping into the inherent potential that resides within our students and the commitment of their surrounding community to power the future of school instruction. They devote their lives to upend the state of education as we know it, despite the odds, in the face of opposition, and through COVID. So up next, we speak with an executive who leads a nonprofit organization that helps families navigate the local school system and what this exasperating last year has revealed for the education options that are available to them. Then we'll meet the trailblazer who founded a homeschool cooperative during the pandemic with the impetus for communities to take the education of their families into their own hands.
For a while, even really before I had children, I would say, critical of the American public education system. And, you know, I'm not really a person to complain and just talk about what's bad. Like, I feel like if there's anything I can do, I want to take action. And I know a lot of people kind of have the approach that if you want to make change, you need to be on the inside. to make change. And while there is some value to that thought, for me personally, if I'm not satisfied with something, generally my conviction is to build something that I'm satisfied with.
And we'll visit the early childhood influences that ignited their passions for education and what singular traumatic event transformed their lives.
Yeah, so I think for me and like so many of us from St. Louis, my moment was absolutely August 9th of 2014.
One thing that really got me to the point where I am now was the death of Michael Brown.
From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here. Parents have increasing concerns about public schools and their ability to meet their children's educational needs. But what are their options?
People without access to basic internet and other things that you would consider a necessity for our current world have been left behind in a lot of aspects. And for children, it has done a lot to their social emotional development and growth, and contributed to what people in education call learning loss, because the transition happened and it wasn't really tempered for people that didn't have the resources to take advantage of it.
That's Anastasia Allen. She's the executive director for Navigate STL Schools. She's worked in education for about 12 years, from higher ed to K through 12.
When I was young, it was, you're not always going to have a calculator in your pocket. But it was to that point where they were like discouraging students from using technology in the classroom. And now technology is the classroom and virtual learning is a platform, and knowing how to use Zoom and some of the video technologies and chats and things, like they're doing innovative things with TikTok and other social media content in terms of like how you can present projects in upper grades. And so those were just things that people just did not think would be possible if you had asked them in February of 2020.
The pandemic has changed much about education over the last year, especially the way instruction is accessed. The once rigidly restrictive technology prohibitions have had to be reversed. Now, in the classroom, technology provides key instructional tools for delivering curriculum to children whose districts have had to resort to remote learning modalities.
One-to-one technology is a really big one. For a long time, teachers and advocates have been saying kids need access to computers. They need to learn how to code. They need to be able to interact with technology in the classroom. It shouldn't be a punishment to have a cell phone or a privilege to have a computer in the classroom. Like, these are basic rights, especially given where we are as a society, that every child needs to have access to it.
Once again, equity and access emerge as barriers. Allen says districts don't have the infrastructure to provide laptops, iPads, or hotspots to all of their families.
People are interested in having this type of support, especially as they are continually being almost hurt by the school system and the confusion that they're experiencing in terms of the pandemic. And so our goal is really to make sure that we can support families regardless of what the current system is, because the education train isn't really stopping for anybody. Schools aren't adjusting deadlines. They're not going to stop doing what they have to do. And so we don't want parents to kind of get stuck in that in-between space.
And she's very concerned about the impact, a widening learning gap that this disparity presents.
Poor kids are getting left behind. I don't know another way to say that. There are students who need the most help, and they were struggling to get that help in classroom and in person, and now they're struggling even more to get that help now that they're removed from the additional resources and supports that they were supposed to have. And so you're seeing just these gaps deepen in terms of grade level reading, math, social and cognitive abilities for specific students, that people already knew were going to be gaps, but now they're almost chasms because they've lost almost 2 years of that kind of contact.
This is where Navigate STL responds according to their mission.
So one of the great things, I actually just finished a conversation about this, is that we launched in the middle of the pandemic, so we didn't have to make changes. Our whole model is really been built around how do we serve people who are furthest removed from resources when we can't contact them.
They listened and were responsive to what they heard parents cared about the most.
Does the school have a good safety plan? Like, how are you going to make sure that my kid doesn't get sick and their teachers and their friends don't get sick? That's number one. Number two is how are you ensuring that my kid still gets a childhood? That they're not in some sort of like quarantine-esque learning style, that they still get to make memories and join clubs and do arts and crafts and potentially play sports. And then does the school support us as a family? Because there have been times where parents have been yelled at for speaking in their own home while the kid was on virtual learning by teachers. And so just do you respect that everybody's going through like a hard time right now and adjustments need to be made? And can you still empathize with my student and with our family situation throughout that experience to make sure that they are still having a quality learning experience as a child? But then, did you adjust well during the pandemic? Was my child still able to learn? Can they read? Can they do math? Are you making an attempt to make this process easy for them, or are you making it unnecessarily harder by overly assigning things and having them do busy work and things like that? Like, those are things that parents have cared about.
It is this whole child approach that is central to a broader conversation around equity in education and informs the work of our academic Avengers. For them, the whole child includes their family, friends, as well as community. It's an old familiar adage or proverb that it takes a village. In this village, we are all in together, our triumphs along with our trauma. Once again, Alicia Saunier, St. Louis Public Schools Board of Education.
Yeah, so I think for me and like so many of us from St. Louis, my moment was absolutely August 9th of 2014. At that time, I was getting ready to enter. I was getting ready to start my first year at St. Louis University. But August 9th was when Michael Brown was murdered. And what I saw that made me go out there that first night was his mom saying, like, do you know how hard I worked to get my son through high school? And then what I remember like feeling attached to him from that moment was like, wow, like we were supposed to be starting this next educational journey together. We were supposed to be side by side.
Coming up, the early childhood influences that ignited their passions for education. And we'll take a seat at the front of the classroom and visit Sovereign University Homeschooling Cooperative to learn more about Dr. Harrell's approach, his call for change, and invitation to families. This is We Live Here. Let's step back a bit in time. It is those pivotal and generational experiences that not only shaped our innovators, but illuminated their paths to bring forth change to educational institutions. Dr. Howard Fields recalls his early memories of education.
I remember a sense of community. I attended the overwhelming majority of my years in the Riverview Gardens School District. And what I remember most was this sense of true community within the school. I remember a sense of having extremely high expectations for students. And I also remember having support that was necessary in order for students to flourish.
The same holds true for Dr. Sean Harrell. He remembers his childhood and what shaped his ideas of education before he was even of age to attend school.
In retrospect, I figured out I've been an educator since I was a kid, starting off with like playing school at home. And having my aunts and uncles be the students and I lead the class. At that time, that experience that I'm talking about, I was like maybe 4 or 5. So I didn't even have a lot of examples of what education or classroom was beginning to look like. I just know that I liked hanging out with my grandma and her sisters and brothers, and it was fun with them being the students. And I don't know, I just enjoyed it. And then that kind of moved on to me, you know, helping people throughout the years. I have a childhood friend who's credited me with helping him learn multiplication and the timetables.
And then his calling became clear.
One thing that really got me to the point where I am now was the death of Michael Brown. My conviction and the calling for education became stronger and clearer to me. And being on West Florissant and going to protest and being around the energy of frustration and looking for answers, the one common thread that I took from that time was to organize and organize and organize. And I just kept hearing organizing. So with my experience and expertise being in education, I decided that my contribution to organizing would be through education and through the founding of a school, which is currently now a homeschooling cooperative, which is Sovereign University.
Harrell, just shy of 40 years old, founded Sovereign University out of his home with and for his family.
I have a wife and 4 children, 3 of which I homeschool within the cooperative, and the other one is just too young, but she'll definitely be with us. So I have a 10-year-old in 5th grade. I have an 8-year-old in 3rd grade. I have a 6-year-old who is in 1st grade, but I don't know, she's tackling any level of, you know, work that she can. And then I have a 3-year-old who is eagerly, you know, waiting to get into her educational endeavors with her family.
And for the sake of their futures, it was time.
Beginning the homeschooling cooperative really was, you know, a goal of mine that I didn't necessarily expect to happen so soon or in the manner that it happened. But the COVID pandemic kind of created the perfect storm of opportunity. And I'm fortunate that I had a support system and, you know, had done some preparation that would allow me to take advantage of the opportunity.
Opportunities that Dr. Harrell says were not, but should have been accessible to him as he progressed through school.
American students aren't as competitive as other countries around the world as far as education. Even right now, with having such a big stronghold on the tech industry and being major players in the information age, I don't know, I just think that in that way, we've been failed. I graduated high school in 2000, and I don't think there's any way I should have gotten out of high school without having a strong introduction to things like coding, which is now we see so many jobs that are going unfilled. We hear about the ethnic and racial disparity in the tech field. And I went to a science and technology high school, and, you know, I mean, I couldn't get a coding job today. And I feel like, you know, those type of things that I feel like are opportunities missed, I'm making it my job to not let another generation pass without opportunities to thrive and be competitive in the future.
It's a job that traditional public education was just not designed to fulfill.
And so now a lot of my focus as far as ideas and career fields and paths that I'm within technology that we already have began to introduce to the youth that I work with. Of course, coding, but I think drone operation and maintenance, cybersecurity is a, you know, a field that there's a lot of promise and prosperity toward. But I spent a lot of time researching where I think the world and the economy is going, and I reverse engineer my educational programs and curriculums to be able to meet those needs. So, you know, we're introducing the children to concepts and ideas of artificial intelligence, augmented reality, which they don't even realize that they're so familiar with, but anyone who's used a Snapchat or TikTok filter has participated in the augmented reality field. And I want to make that connection and strengthen that bridge from our community being strictly consumers and increasing our role as manufacturers and producers. I believe that most public education is not designed to groom and empower people to be their best selves. It's more so designed to mold them into someone who can fit in the systems that are already established. It doesn't necessarily promote building new systems. And I just really thought that we can do more and you know, kind of looking on things at a global scale.
So, welcome to Sovereign University.
What is this? Have a seat, Mark. Have a seat. Have a seat, Mark. You got questions, Sean?
Okay. I got it. We can do
it. Nature has a tendency to recycle patterns. The cyclical pattern of nature is the reason that fractals exist.
The science itself was our first topic for this year, and we extracted DNA and really just understanding how our cells, our bodies, our behaviors mimic the patterns of the natural universe and the world around us. So you see the spirals when you look at a telescopic view of the universe, and then you can look down at your fingertip and see some of those same similar spiral patterns that are found, you know, from nature all the way down to our bodies. We talk about fractals.
These are rivers. It starts so just like the Mississippi River. It's one big river, and it has smaller...
That looks like a whole tree.
You see how we got the main part of the river, and it branches off into smaller ones?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And then the line.
This is a root system of a tree. Same pattern.
Yep. Yeah. And then lightning.
This is lightning.
Same.
Look familiar?
Yes.
Same pattern.
Lightning.
What's this?
I have no idea.
Wait, don't tell me.
A tree.
Many of our approaches is based in experiential learning, which is what my doctoral research was in, multiple intelligence approaches, whereas there's no one correct way to gauge and judge intelligences because we are, you know, multidimensional people, and it's not always accurate to judge us based off of a written test that has been the result of, you know, lectures, which is a teaching style that, you know, I think is kind of dying.
This comes out the sky, same as the river networks. So what's in you is in the ground, it's coming out the sky, and it's running through the land.
Today, the students, or as Dr. Harrell intentionally and affectionately addresses them, the scholars today are learning valuable fundamental lessons. The immersion of themselves and the world they live in resonates with immediate connections, understandings, and of course, inquiry.
If lightning is inside of you, if you don't have any...
So let's slow down. I'm not saying that lightning is inside of you, but what I am saying is that the pattern that lightning produces, that pattern is in you.
Oh.
Okay, we all clear?
Lightning.
Yes, Kai?
Where are your DNA?
Where's your DNA found? It's like it's code within your body. DNA is the information. Don't think of it as a physical thing that's in your body. It's the information that runs throughout your body. All right.
I just took a piece of DNA.
Any other questions? Great question, though.
While innovative, its one-room, mixed age and gender classroom is reminiscent to the schoolhouses of America's 1800s, Harrell says it still works.
Well, I would say that the mixed ages is right now is definitely a result of us just being small. But in this time that we've taken that approach, I've seen a lot of good things. I've seen opportunities for mentorship with our older scholars, and I see opportunities for the younger scholars to look up and set goals and see what older scholars are doing so that they kind of have something to achieve and goals to set for themselves. I think that it is more reflective of how life really is, because, you know, we go throughout school working and learning with peers who are very similar to us, who are close in age and may have kind of the same similar backgrounds and thought patterns. And then we go out into the work world and we work with people of of all ages, of all different backgrounds, from all walks of life. And I think that having those opportunities to learn within a mixed age setting might help with making that transition easier, or just having a better understanding of that expectation that we all have to work together. And there's a lot to be learned from the excitement of the youth, and just as much to be learned as from the wisdom of an elder.
And with specific emphasis on what the world of their future may actually look like, Sovereign University marks a new day for families and their options for educating their children. If families choose to do so, they can take the lead with their children's academic programs.
A lot of times, parents and people in general, we see the job of educating our children as the responsibility of the state, so to speak, or of private institutions. And I don't necessarily agree with that. I come from more of a community-focused background with my approach to education, whereas parents partner up and, you know, share the expertise that they have with all of, you know, the children in their surrounding area. And I do think that education can really be that simple.
And like each of these pioneers who are taking on the state of education head-on, he says the scholars and their futures are more than well worth it.
Parents have to be brave. Like I said, it definitely can be nerve-wracking, and you know, it's not always easy, but like I said, I believe in it. I'm not necessarily calling for education to be revised. I'm calling for a revolution. And you know, the path of a revolutionary is to cross a bridge of no return. And you know, I'm very focused on crossing this bridge of education and taking as many families, like-minded parents, and youth with me who, you know, see the benefits of it.
We Live Here is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Jade Harrell, Director of On-Demand Content and Community Partnerships. Special thanks to Alicia Saunier, Dr. Howard Fields, Anastasia Allen, and Dr. Sean Harrell for not only contributing to this episode, but for the exceptional work that they do every single day. Find out more about our guests, get show notes and more information, and of course, check out our previous episodes at stlpr.org. St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Understanding starts here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.